From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. Brooke Gladstone is away. I'm Bob Garfield. When Attorney General John Ashcroft was preparing a second phase of the Patriot Act, the Center for Public Integrity got a hold of a working draft and released it publicly. The ensuing uproar over draconian police powers killed that legislation aborning. Call that the frog jumping into a pot of boiling water and jumping in a panic right out. But what if you put the frog in warm water and raise the temperature one slow degree at a time? That seems to be the Bush administration's strategy behind a new provision in the Intelligence Reauthorization Bill signed by the president late last year. Unbundled from the scuttled Patriot Act II and inserted into the routine spending bill, it gives subpoena power to federal investigators for a whole range of information from any broadly defined financial institution, which means the government can now obtain a terrorist's credit card expenditures, or yours, secretly without a court order. But where were the shouts of warning this time? James Dempsey, executive director of the Center for Democracy and Technology, says the slow boil method has a lulling effect and the media are only partly to blame.
Well, I think to some extent we all dropped the ball. My office, which I think was the first who discovered it, we didn't realize the import of this provision until after it had passed both houses. We did issue a little press thing at the time when it was still not finally enacted. We didn't push it. We didn't hype it. We didn't pump it. And it did remain very much below the radar screen. There was a little blow up on the floor when the conference report, the final form of the bill, was brought forth for final passage. But by then, it was certainly too late.
Maybe I'm naive, but it seems to me that when some legislator is trying to bury a particularly sensitive provision in an otherwise mundane piece of legislation, that there's a staffer on the Hill who will immediately get on the phone and call all the usual suspects in the interest groups and in the press to say, you know, check out paragraph such and such of the omnibus such and such spending bill because this is a really bad deal. Where were those tip calls during the debate over the Intelligence Authorization Act?
I have to say that to some extent, those staffers are nervous about their own jobs. They, again, the Intelligence Authorization Bill, although the bill itself is ultimately public, the numbers behind it are secret, and almost all of the debate leading to it is conducted in the cone of silence. And there is a specific case within the past year and a half where a staffer did precisely what you suggested, and that staffer lost his or her job over that. So that has a chilling effect, absolutely. Those folks, it's a tough job, and they really are very nervous.
And is there any reason that I shouldn't be terrified by the scenario that you just described?
Well, I think overall, in the past 2.5 years since 9/11, one of the major themes of concern has been the growth of secrecy, including secrecy, again, that I don't think comes close to protecting the national security, but that does obscure government decision-making from the kind of oversight that the public deserves and the kind of oversight that will actually help us win this war. We need that oversight to win this war on terrorism. But I'm afraid that secrecy has become the byword, not only in the executive branch, but increasing sensitivity in Congress. I think there's a concern that the intelligence committees of the Congress generally are being certainly less publicly questioning of anything that the government is undertaking.
Well, apart from admonishing us to generally be vigilant, how would you advise the press to recognize these end-arounds that, I don't know if they subvert the process, but they certainly avoid the scrutiny of the media and enable legislation like this to become law?
Well, I think that the press, by and large, has been pretty good on covering the issues and of recognizing that a lot of what the government is saying just doesn't quite add up. and of being prepared to report on that. I'm really looking at this incident from the perspective of what I need to do differently. When I finally said to a reporter, you know, why didn't you cover this when it could have made a difference? He said, well, why didn't you call me up and stick it in front of my nose? And he had a point, so I didn't do that. Next time I'm going to try to.
Well, Jim, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
James Dempsey is Executive Director of the Center for Democracy and Technology. Sometimes the administration circumvents citizen nervousness. Sometimes the administration cultivates it. The orange alert over the holidays rattled the world. But only afterward did we learn the nature of the threat, concern that a dirty bomb might be detonated in a major city spewing radiation in the air. An alarming prospect, but how alarming exactly? Though panic would no doubt ensue, loss of life and property damage would likely be quite limited. So why has the White House done so little to educate the public about dirty bombs, and, for that matter, any potential terrorist threat? And why has the press neither challenged government officials on this lapse nor tried to fill in the gaps themselves? On the Media's John Solomon explains.
8:31. This just in to the WTOP newsroom.
We are getting reports of an explosion near the Van Ness Metro station. The Connecticut Avenue entrance reportedly is caved in. Now, we have a reporter heading to the scene now, and we will give you more details as they become...
The bad news, the explosion turned out to be a terrorist bomb laced with plutonium. The good news? This was an excerpt from a mock radio cast produced for a National Academy of Engineering workshop to see how government officials and journalists would handle a dirty bomb attack. The most important news is what they found out from the exercise.
I think that we're ill-prepared.
National Academy official Randy Atkins organized the simulation.
It was pretty clear that there was a lot of confusion about, for example, simple buzzwords that are probably going to create panic in the public. Nuclear, radiological, what's potassium iodide, plutonium.
Atkins says that many of those engaged in the exercise had trouble explaining the difference between a dirty bomb and a full-scale nuclear device. A local weatherman there mistakenly warned that a plume of radiation would spread, imperiling the whole region.
These are all things that are going to cause people near the incident to panic. It's going to cause traffic jams. It's going to cause delays in getting first responders to the scene. It's going to cause people to pull back from victims that really need help. It's going to cause people to run when perhaps they should stay in place.
The Bush administration has long understood the need to address this scenario with the public and the media. In March of 2002, the Center for Strategic and International Studies held a similar exercise. This time the dirty bomb exploded on the Washington Mall, with top U.S. Homeland Security officials in attendance. As one later told Steve Brill for his book, After, How America Confronted the September 12th Era, we know we have to deal with this sooner or later. Almost 2 years later, they still haven't. Even though Brill says officials told him that they would be surprised if that type of attack doesn't happen here in the near future.
I don't think they've treated it like the urgent threat that it is. The whole idea ought to be to just take that weapon out of the arsenal of the terrorists. And this is one situation where you can take the weapon away without spending money, without shooting people, and without 2 years of planning. If I were Tom Ridge and George Bush, I'd ask for a half hour of network time to hold a teach-in about dirty bombs. The time to give that speech is now, not 2 hours after someone sets off one of these bombs and everybody's panicked, because it's not going to work then.
In the more than 2 years since the September 11th attacks, President Bush has never addressed the country on dirty bombs, nor for that matter, any civil defense issue. Veteran Wall Street Journal reporter Cynthia Crossan, author of Tainted Truth, The Manipulation of Fact in America, suggests there may be a political motive.
They like the idea that they can say the words dirty bomb and send people into a panic, that there's a certain kind of power. If you have people fearful about their lives and the possibility of an attack, it makes it easier to advance an agenda, a political agenda, which is less privacy and more government control and observation of its citizens.
Stephen Brill attributes better, if short-sighted, intentions to the government.
I suspect that the thinking in the White House is, well, gee, we don't want to scare people. And there's something to that. But the fact is that the cost of scaring people a little bit today compared to the cost of people being, you know, ignorant and panicked when something happens, that's an easy decision.
But this less is more approach may be misjudging the public. A recent Carnegie Mellon University study found that 8 of 10 Americans want the government to provide them honest, accurate information about terrorism, even if it is worrisome. Brill says the press isn't serving the public well either.
We can blame the government for this, but everyone in the media should blame themselves. I mean, there's nothing stopping, you know, NBC from doing a special on how to deal with this stuff, except the fact that they won't get the same ratings as they get from, you know, a show ironically called Fear Factor.
Cynthia Crossan is puzzled by the lack of coverage. Maybe, she surmises, it's just the sheer magnitude and mystery of the possibilities.
Nobody has ever hijacked planes and flown them into big buildings before. That was beyond our imagination. And now I think there's some sense, too, that whatever's going to come next, it's not something that we're even thinking about. So it does put both the government and the media in a bind to try to go through, okay, here's what to do with a dirty bomb, here's what to do with, all the while knowing that that is a little bit of grasping straws.
The National Academy's Randy Atkins organized the workshop in large part to help the media understand and communicate these complex and unfamiliar topics.
We need to challenge journalists to find ways of making this material interesting. It is science. It is engineering. I think that it sometimes is difficult to get the public engaged in it. And I think it's almost more difficult sometimes to get journalists engaged. And I see journalists as people that to a large extent probably went to journalism school to do things other than science and engineering, and they're certainly not going to go out of their way to report on these sort of issues now.
Since this story first aired, one journalist has announced plans to try to engage the public and the press on these issues. At the request of U.S. Homeland Security Secretary Tom Ridge, author Stephen Brill announced last month the formation of a new group, the America Prepared Campaign, to galvanize the private sector, particularly the media and the entertainment industries, to assist in improving public preparedness. For On the Media, this is John Solomon.
Coming up, cracks in China's press freedom promises, the liberal answer to Rush Limbaugh, and Journalism Ethics 101. This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. Brooke Gladstone is out of town. I'm Bob Garfield. This week we learned of the newest wrinkle in the Valerie Plame affair. Plame is the wife of former Ambassador Joseph Wilson, whose skeptical report about a supposed Iraqi uranium purchase in Niger contradicted those famous 16 words in President Bush's State of the Union speech. In an apparent attempt to undercut Wilson's credibility, a government source leaked to conservative columnist Bob Novak the juicy fact that Wilson's wife Plame was a CIA officer who helped her husband get the Niger investigation gig. Now, to find the source of that leak, federal investigators are asking select members of the administration to sign a release to relieve journalists from any pledge of confidentiality. This raises some interesting ethical questions, and who better to answer them than Ali Colon, ethics group leader at the Poynter Institute. Ali, welcome to the show.
Hello, Bob.
let's lay out the ethical basics here. Undoubtedly, there are those out there who are watching this whole thing unfold who can't believe that a special counsel is prepared to spend millions of taxpayer dollars to find the leaker when Bob Novak could solve the problem in a second and for free by just outing his source. Why should Robert Novak keep his mouth shut?
Well, the cost monetarily might be free, but the cost to journalism and sources who rely on journalists to keep their word would be quite high.
Are there any even hypothetical reasons that would give Robert Novak license to blab? For example, the fact that this is a government source who may have been misusing his government knowledge and authority to harm a private citizen.
The important thing to remember is what you're promising with regards to your source. And so there are options, and I don't know what they are with Mr. Novak here, but there are options with regards to how you handle that kind of agreement that may, in fact, allow you to provide the information in certain circumstances. I'll give you just a different type of example that I'm familiar with. At the Seattle Times, where I worked as an editor and as a reporter, during the coverage of Senator Brock Adams, who was a senator at that time, and the allegations regarding sexual harassment that took place, there was a lot of reporting done that sought information from what would be anonymous sources, women who wanted to speak about the issue but not be identified. What the Times did in that case was to promise them anonymity, but also to have them agree that if the senator brought this to trial or went to court, they would agree to be identified. And so they arranged for a way of maintaining a promise of confidentiality with conditions which the sources agreed to should the circumstances change.
Okay, got that. But now there is this new wrinkle in the Plame case, mm-hmm. and that is that federal investigators are asking Bush administration officials to sign a release that would give Novak permission to identify the source. Let's just say that Novak promised unequivocally to protect the anonymity of the source. If presented ex post facto with a release, does Novak have to honor it if it was, for all intents and purposes, signed under duress?
I don't think it changes the obligation that Mr. Novak has if he's made the promise to keep it that way, because the person, I think, would directly have to come to him and release him. And then there's an even shorter cut to that, which is for the person simply to identify themselves.
It looks like no matter what Bob Novak does, somehow journalism is going to have egg on its face. Either he's going to scandalize himself and the trade by giving up a source, or he's going to scandalize himself and the trade for allowing some government official to harm Wilson and Plame, or he's going to embarrass himself by wasting a lot of taxpayer dollars by not surrendering voluntarily a name that a very expensive investigation is ultimately going to turn up anyway. So we can't win for losing, can we?
Well, it would seem that way, although I think it's important that people understand that there are no rules, regulations, or law that govern this kind of activity, that we're standing on principles here. And I do think there's an opportunity to use the Novak case to educate the public about what the use of anonymous sources entails, what its dangers are, how it should be done, why it's done, and in fact, better yet, why it should be avoided whenever possible altogether.
Well, Ali, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ali Colon is an ethicist with the Poynter Institute in St. Petersburg, Florida. And now for the second installment in our two-part series on Pakistani media. Last time, we looked at the Pakistani press and how it has changed under President General Pervez Musharraf. Although most journalists agree that Musharraf allows more press freedom than ever before, the print media continue to be threatened by military and clerical intimidation. Radio and TV networks suffer from similar pressures, but for the first time in Pakistan's history, the broadcast media are breaking loose of the government's shackles. Last year, the state reformed its electronic media laws, allowing several private channels to hit the airwaves. Miranda Kennedy reports.
In a country where the teachings of the Quran are primary, the media have often been subservient. When Pakistan was founded in 1947, the right to information was not enshrined in the constitution. Now, Pakistani President General Pervez Musharraf walks a fine line to balance the demands of religious conservatives with the powerful military establishment and with new pressure from the U.S. to democratize.
BTV National.
Aapka Qaumi Channel.
Nothing better demonstrates the conflicting forces pulling at Pakistan than its state media. The government, that is, whichever government is in power, controls an official news agency, the all-pervasive Radio Pakistan network, and a state TV network, PTV. Aside from the regime it supports, not much has changed on PTV in its 40 years of existence. The network's four channels are notable for their dry, propagandist tone, decked out with 60s-style sets and graphics. Still, PTV is watched by most of Pakistan because it is accessible and free. State radio is even less cutting-edge than PTV, and its content is screened by the same watchful state eye. Masroor Hussain is an anchor at Radio Pakistan, and he says his work is strictly monitored by a rather Orwellian trinity.
What happens is that the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, Ministry of Information, and the intelligence agencies, they send their directives to a consultant who works with Radio Pakistan. And the consultant then holds a meeting with the producer, and they give the line of questioning to the producer, and the producer asks me to put that into a journalistic form.
State media can be very useful in the concentration of official power. When there was a government coup in 1999 and General Musharraf, the incoming president, didn't want the public to know, then they simply did not know. While BBC and CNN broadcast news of a military takeover in Pakistan, PTV played pre-recorded family dramas until Musharraf made an announcement on PTV several hours later.
There was a complete blackout because there was no alternative media out here.
Imran Aslam is president of GeoTV, Pakistan's leading private TV news station, which was launched only last year. He often wonders what Musharraf's government might do to the media if there were another national emergency.
We as well are dependent upon the cable network. I don't know what they would do in a situation like this, whether they would, you know, immediately put everything off the air, thereby forcing us to go off too. But certainly if something like that happened, we would scramble and we would try to get the news out. And I think that the governments have also begun to realize it's very difficult to keep anything like this out. It will filter through.
Pakistan has allowed private domestic TV news channels into the market, but they are still very carefully controlled. Jio cannot uplink from Pakistani soil, so it has to employ a team in Dubai to receive news from Pakistan and send the content out to the satellite and beam it back to Pakistan. This setup completely cripples live coverage. Nevertheless, Jio and other private channels have brought change to Pakistani TV news. Again, Imran Aslam.
We made an impact because of the fact that we were focusing on news, which is a rare commodity in Pakistan prior to the arrival of Jio, because it was all state-controlled. The word on the street was, PTV seeing is not believing. I don't think people accepted everything that they were watching on PTV as the truth. They realized it was contaminated by government propaganda. So there was a need, obviously, for something that people could start believing in.
Radio has followed fast behind TV. The government just issued licenses for some 30 privately owned FM radio stations. But there's a limit. The stations are barred from airing news or public affairs programming that is not produced by the state. For government-employed journalists who can broadcast the news, the private stations present another challenge. Seema Siddiqui is a program director at Radio Pakistan in Islamabad.
The electronic media has always been government-owned. We were not in competition with anybody previously. Now, to keep our listeners and to keep our viewers and to keep our audience, we need to be more open. People have a broader canvas of judging for themselves what is true and what is untrue. So you have to cater to that if you want to stay in the race.
State-employed journalists admit that their viewer and listenership have taken a beating simply because Pakistanis now have so many channels to choose from. Successful TV stations like GEO also boast of their strong political impact. Before privatization, broadcast media seldom aired the views of the opposition. Now, GEO not only airs political counterpoints, but has a show satirizing General Musharraf, in which a lookalike struts around the set shouting at army officers to pay attention to him. Musharraf may not like the show, but producers proudly scoff that there's nothing he can do about it. For a country that once flogged and jailed journalists who published comments critical of the establishment, that's a great leap forward. For On the Media, I'm Miranda Kennedy in Islamabad.
SARS is back in the news this week, but this time, instead of face masks, the image most associated with the virus is the civet cat. Chinese authorities have fingered that animal as a possible source of SARS and have begun exterminating them by the thousand. This proactive response from the government is in stark contrast to its clampdown on information last year, which contributed to the rapid spread of SARS. But rather than learn from the lessons in transparency, the repressive Chinese government is up to its old tricks. Last week, police paid a visit to the offices of Southern Metropolis Daily, a muckraking regional newspaper that first reported the return of SARS. The reporter who broke the story and her editor were detained and have been placed on leave. Orville Schell has been following these events and joins us now from the Journalism School at the University of California at Berkeley, where he is dean. Professor, welcome back to OTM.
Pleasure to be on.
Now, the reason for the raid and for the firings given by the Chinese government was financial irregularities. Is there any reason to believe that this had anything to do with financial crime?
Well, usually there isn't. One can't say certainly, but this is an acceptable offense in China, whereas it is unacceptable to arrest people for political crimes. There's a very long history of sort of cat and mouse between the Department of Propaganda, which controls media outlets, and these media outlets that are ever more market-driven. So they've got to meet their bottom line. To do that, they have to be very edgy, and they have to provide stories that people want to read. So there's a contradiction inherent in this new proposition of sort of market-Leninism in which the press finds itself all over China.
When we spoke last year, the first SARS epidemic was in full swing, and I asked you whether the embarrassment that the Chinese government experienced after the cover-up would open up a sort of Pandora's box of free expression by the media, which seems to have happened. Is what's happening now that the government is just trying to slam shut Pandora's box?
I think we did see a spasm of opening up. And some of these publications had some other interesting investigative stories that, from the perspective of many in the party, were embarrassing. And now what we see is an attempt to try to sort of bring the press back under the umbrella of control, lest they get the habit of thinking that they have broken loose in some structural and long-term way. But China tends to operate in curious cycles. You know, it will be free, and then it'll get too free, and then the government will start cracking down again. It's something like those metals whose properties are that if you heat it, it straightens out, but when it cools, it returns to its original shape.
Do you even get the sense that these spasms are jerking freedom two steps forward and one step back, or maybe is it one step forward and two steps back? Over time, will there be a net increase in free expression, or is it just going to get more and more retrograde?
Well, you know, that question lies at the heart of the matter. I think we do see two steps forward and one step backwards, and sometimes we see three steps backwards. But if you compare the press in China today to the way it was 20 years ago in the early 80s, I think you would have to conclude that it is more constrained than it was then, because at that point, just as the reforms began, the official press was sort of more liberated than it is now. Now we see the commercial press somewhat more open and somewhat more vibrant. But the problem is that all of these changes are acted out against the backdrop of a system which believes that the press cannot, should not be independent of the government itself.
Well, you know, tell me if I'm just grossly overstating here, but it seems that for all of the hopes and visions of a free society evolving from open markets, at the moment we're simply talking about a country that is a fascist state exploiting cheap labor and working its way into the world economy without working its way at all into the community of nations.
Well, you know, as somebody who first started studying China back in the late 50s, I would have to say that I've been quite amazed over the last 15 years at the degree to which, after the shock of 1989 and all of the market reforms since, at the degree to which they've been able to maintain control over certain key sectors, such as the media, dissidents, politics, you know, the system has not failed. But I think at the core of this system of control is a sense that as long as the party can deliver economically, people are willing to put up with much less freedom. The minute that people don't any longer feel that they're on some sort of an escalator that's economically taking them upwards, then I think we may end up with a very different situation. And then, of course, the media becomes very critical in explaining what is wrong. As long as they can keep the engine of growth rates high, they probably won't have to confront the question of why don't they have a free media? Why don't they have, you know, due process? Why don't they have rights?
Professor Schell, as always, thank you so much.
Always a pleasure.
Orville Schell is the Dean of the Graduate School of Journalism at the University of California at Berkeley. Coming up, a conservative talk radio host gets a liberal makeover, and quite possibly the only report you will ever hear on the D.C. primary. This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this and other NPR member stations and the Kresge Foundation, building the capacity of nonprofit organizations through challenge grants since 1924, on the web at kresge.org. The Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in individuals, their families, and their communities, on the web at www.wkkf.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, making grants to improve the health and healthcare of all Americans, on the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is On the Media from NPR. I'm Bob Garfield. And now for some of your letters. We got a number of complaints about Brooke's conversation last week with Michael Goldfarb, who wrapped up the year in British media for us. Kristen Lems wrote in with this. Wow, what a disappointment to hear Michael Goldfarb pedaling madly to the right side of the road as he scolded British journalists such as Robert Fisk for sensationalism, trying to sort out the, quote, bad or anti-occupation journalists from the good or look-the-other-way ones. And Lems ended with this, On the media, look to thine own biases before judging those who really practice a free press. Stephen Fillion of Minneapolis, Minnesota, wrote this about the same interview. I found your review of the British media to be quite close to what I would expect from Fox News, criticizing their outlets for not being pro-war. Fillion added, your slanted attack on the British media might make it easier for American reporters to forget their failures to report on the numerous revelations of exaggeration or outright lies that characterized Bush and Blair's so-called weapons of mass destruction claims. That would be a terrible shame, for the British media was far ahead of the American media in this respect. And finally, here's a very troubling notice from Dave Kessler of Stony Brook, New York. I'm really worried about Bob, he writes. He just isn't funny anymore. What happened? Was there a crackdown from the WNYC brass on all things snide, sarcastic, and silly? Is he just tired of it all? Is he depressed? Well, no, Dave, I'm not depressed. Maybe a little moody and unmotivated, eating a lot of pudding. But really, it's just a question of time. We can't shamelessly slant the news to suit our corporate and governmental masters and be hilarious. But if you'll be patient with us for a few more minutes, we can at least deliver snide and silly. No guarantees on funny. Meantime, keep those letters coming in. We just love them. Don't forget to include your name and where you live. What's wrong with this sound picture?
Democracy has a new voice. It's the Ed Schultz Show. Coast to coast, border to border. Powerful, passionate, persistent. Now, Ed Schultz.
That's especially at the dinner table. Mad cow, never heard of it. Pass the meat plate.
Sure sounds like right-wing talk radio, but it isn't. It's liberal talk radio, the Ed Schultz Show, syndicated by the Jones Radio Networks each weekday from 3 to 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Like the Tim Robbins character in the 1992 film Bob Roberts, Schultz has expropriated the styles and techniques of his political opposites to make his message palatable to the heartland and beyond. And Schultz should know these techniques because before he was a liberal talk show host, Schultz himself was a conservative talk show host. But he's defected, and two of his very first guests this week were none other than Democratic Senators Tom Daschle and Hillary Clinton. Ed Schultz joins me now from Fargo, North Dakota. Ed, welcome to our show.
Good to be here with you.
So when the idea of a liberal radio talk show came up, much of the discussion centered on how difficult it would be to pull off because by the very nature of liberal thought, a show couldn't be sufficiently caustic or bombastic enough to grab hold of middle American listeners. I guess one thing we've learned is that it can be caustic and bombastic. That's your style, isn't it?
I would say that's accurate. I think it's one of the biggest fallacies in broadcast that a different school of thought other than hard right conservative radio can't work. Those who have tried it have failed, but they weren't radio people. They didn't have the experience. They didn't have the credentials. They didn't have the ratings. And if you don't have ratings and revenue, you're not going to be around very long in this business.
Well, one thing I've noticed from the early broadcasts is that your show isn't filled with all sorts of lofty philosophical meanderings or very sophisticated policy discussions. It's much more of a meat and potatoes kind of broadcast. Let's listen to a bit of it.
Now, here's what we need to do. I got an emailer over the weekend saying, look, you've got to ask Hillary about these calls that are going out around the Midwest by the NRA saying that Hillary's out to take your gun. So I figured that you should get me that picture of you duck hunting so we can put that on our webpage so we can answer that once and for all, huh?
Well, Ed, I think that's a heck of a good idea. You know, and I hope you'll tell everybody, I really don't want anybody's gun. I just don't want, you know, criminals and you know, stalkers and children and gang members, you know, to have guns. I don't have any problem, as you point out, and, you know, using a gun. I've done it. I've got that, that picture of me with my poor old duck, that banded duck I shot one cold morning in Arkansas.
Tell me about the audience that you're speaking to.
Well, I think I'm speaking to middle America. I think I'm speaking to those families that are watching their health care insurance go up at 14% a year, and they're wondering what next year is going to bring. I think I'm talking to those people who take a shower after work that aren't represented anymore by the media elites. I find it ironic that the right-wing conservative talk show hosts in this country love to point the finger at the media elites, yet they're not representing the real people out there. These people are flying in Lear jets, drinking the best whiskey, and smoking the best cigars. They're not down with America. They're talking down to America. And so I see a real void in the media. And yes, I am bombastic. I am aggressive. I just love to tell the conservatives that Democrats died on Omaha Beach. I love to tell them that Democrats died in Vietnam, and I love to tell them that Democrats are dying in Iraq and that we have a stake in this country, too. But if you listen to conservative talk radio in this country and you're a Democrat or you think differently from the way they do, it almost makes you feel like you don't belong in the country. And I say that there's more of us out there than them. And I say that half the country, more than half the country, voted for Al Gore, and I think that there's a huge market for this.
Are you, in fact, a liberal talk show host, or are you just playing one on the radio?
Look, I'm for the working man. I'm for funding of education. I'm for the funding of all the things that have to be done. You want a great country, you need to defend it, you need to educate it, and you need to feed it. And if that makes me a liberal, I want to be the first one in line.
Well, that's a good answer, but let me ask you more directly. In your professional past, among the many, many other things that you've done for a living in the media and outside the media, you have been a conservative talk show host where you were using all of the same professional techniques and tricks of the trade to sell a conservative point of view, and now all of a sudden you're on the other side of the political spectrum. Did you have a come-to-Jesus moment about your personal politics? Or are you an opportunist who's just taken what looks like a pretty good gig?
First of all, I don't need a second job. Secondly, I don't need the money. And beyond that, I went through some real grassroots experiences to bring me to where I am today with the Democratic Party. I took a motor home starting back in the year 2001, and I went into these small towns and I listened. The open mic is what turned my heart and turned my thinking. I went into small town America where farmers were being told that they weren't going to get disaster relief. I saw farmers lose their farms. I went into classrooms with that open microphone and I talked to teachers about them not having the resources and not getting the proper federal funding. And then I went into rural hospitals and I saw that there were over 40 million people in this country without health care insurance. Those grassroots experiences is what brought me to where I am today.
The scales have fallen from your eyes, but tell me about your listeners. Can they believe their ears? When they hear you on the radio now, are they writing to you or calling to you and say, are you the Ed Schultz that I know of?
Well, in this part of the country, there have been those questions in the upper Midwest. But, you know, I can't be all things to all people. But I stick to the issues. I do it with the same style. I think I'm fair. I don't think conservative talk show hosts in this country are fair, and I don't think they're journalists, and I think they try to pass themselves off as that. I'm not a journalist. I'm a talk show host. I can tell a story that maybe other media can't do. I can go out of bounds a little bit. I can be edgy. So as far as a change goes, look, I can look anybody in the eye and defend how I feel.
As you look back on your career as a right-wing radio host, is there a moment that you had on the air that, looking back on it now, makes you just cringe, makes you just wish you could expunge it from recorded history?
Yes, and it refers right to our state of North Dakota, where I would say in the mid-90s I was at odds with our congressional delegation, our two senators and congressmen, and I referred to them as the Three Stooges on the air. If there was one thing that I could take back in my broadcast career, it would be that, because I've learned a lot from them. I didn't understand their mission. I do now. It was an ignorant statement. It wasn't based on any knowledge. It was based on how I was supposed to feel, because at the time I was a conservative.
Ed, many thanks and good luck to you.
Thank you. Thanks for the opportunity.
Ed Schultz is host of The Ed Schultz Show, airing weekdays on a small but growing number of commercial stations.
We're going to be in Iowa. We're going to be in New Hampshire. It's Big Eddie to the rescue. Gun-toting, meat-eating, progressive.
And speaking of New Hampshire and Iowa, Ed Schultz is hardly the only media personality to head there. Quadrennially, people like us swarm on those states like four-year locusts, for whom no cliché is too threadbare, no observation too obvious, no ritual too superficial to be presented to the American public as news. Well, let others do business that way. Working out of NPR headquarters in Washington, D.C., we decided to find the primary story to end all primary stories. A journalistic odyssey that took us first to where all journalistic odysseys begin. The travel desk.
I have to get to New Hampshire. Mm-hmm. What's it going to cost us?
It's going to be expensive. It'll probably be around $700.
About Iowa. Can you, how about Sioux City, Iowa?
$999.99.70?
Ouch.
Let the herding cattle of the press corps forage the overgrazed pasture of Iowa and New Hampshire. The nation's all-important first primary happens Tuesday in Washington, D.C., where the winner will amass, well, technically, zero convention delegates, but nonetheless gather priceless momentum that could propel Wesley Clark or John Kerry or John Edwards or Joseph Lieberman or Dick Gephardt to a presidential nomination. If they were on the ballot, which they aren't, although Dennis Kucinich, Carol Moseley Braun, Lyndon LaRouche, and a fellow named Vermin Supreme are. And so we hit the campaign trail, navigating the length and breadth of this vast and diverse city, from the mountain peaks of the Northwest to the fertile agricultural fields of the Southeast to the factory gates of also the Northwest. We started at the place where politicians converge to chow down on the common delicacies of the proletariat.
When the national press come in here, what do they usually order?
They usually order chili half smoke. It consists of half beef, half pork, smoked sausage, chili cheese fry, and maybe a chocolate shake.
Do you have that in a light?
No, sir.
No light, but plenty of sizzling pre-election heat here at Ben's Chili Bowl, where proprietor Nizam Ali serves up cardiovascular catastrophe and tales from the trail.
Who are you liking?
Sharpton or Carol Moseley Braun?
All of them. That's exactly who I'm voting for. Yeah, we're a restaurant here, and we're trying to be open to all.
Tell me, what did General Clark order when he came into Ben's?
I believe it was a couple half smokes, but I'm not sure.
What did Howard Dean order when he came into Ben's Chili Bowl?
You know, the most popular thing, of course, is the half smokes. But actually, to my knowledge, the Dean supporters come. I don't think he's actually been here.
Carol Moseley Braun?
I'm not sure. Probably so.
John Edwards?
Not John Edwards.
Joe Lieberman?
He should be here, but he hasn't been here.
Dennis Kucinich?
He has been here.
Dennis Kucinich has been here. What did he order?
He got vegetarian chili, actually.
And how do you make a vegetarian chili? You lock him in the freezer, as the dark horse candidate knows only too well. From the urban lowlands, we head the well-trodden path up to Mount Pleasant, which is much like New Hampshire's Mount Washington, although a little less, you know, mountainous.
We've made the trek, as so many have, to historic Mount Pleasant, soaring majestically almost 200 feet above sea level. We approach some men, typical workers wearing white hard hats, salt of the earth, meat and potatoes, peaches and herb of the D.C. electorate.
This is a construction area.
If you fall in that hole right there, get hurt.
I'm liable for it. Don't make me liable.
Okay, thank you very much.
Yes, on the perilous campaign trail, you can stumble. But onward, you must march, this time to the factory gate to intercept lunch pail-bearing workers outside the belching gearworks of throbbing industry. Now, Washington happens to be a little thin in the manufacturing sector.
Welcome to the Cheesecake Factory. My name is Mark.
But nonetheless, we found men and women of various heights and names and so forth bristling with anticipation.
Who's getting your vote on Tuesday?
Not sure yet at this point.
Do you know who's running?
Not really.
Who will you be voting for in Tuesday's election?
What is going on Tuesday?
Who will you be voting for on Tuesday?
Well, I don't know who, because I can vote. No, a citizen of the United States.
And on to the coastal plain, the expanse of fertile loam on the banks of the mighty Anacostia River. the D.C. heartland, where the Anacostia Garden Club tills the soil and the earth yields up some sort of ornamental cabbage, nearly 10 of them, and above them, something colossal and unexpected.
What have we here?
That's just a large chair. It's a very big chair.
Juan Maldonado, Associate General Counsel of the D.C. Lottery Board, has happened by and proudly shows off a part of Washington, D.C. that the world seldom sees. But no, it is not a big chair. It is an enormous chair, 2 stories tall, tucked away at V Street and Martin Luther King Jr. Avenue Southeast, quietly being the world's largest chair.
If you happen to walk by it, you take a look at it, and you say, gee, that's a big chair.
And so, too, the D.C. primary. Like a gigantic piece of unupholstered furniture towering proudly but unseen over the inedible cabbage or cauliflower or kale or whatever of democracy. Here, in a few days' time, history will record the will of a people. Not here at the chair, necessarily, but here in the District of Columbia. And whether Howard Dean scoops up the 0 delegates or Vermin Supreme begins his long, triumphant march to the White House, it's all about the people. You and me and Baby Makes 3. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Katya Rogers, Janine Price, Megan Ryan, and Tony Field. It was engineered by Dylan Keefe and Rob Christensen. We had help from Dave Goldberg and Derek John. The producer of the DC primary piece was Art Silverman. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl. Brooke is our editor. Arun Roth is our senior producer, and Dean Capello, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and get free transcripts and MP3 downloads at onthemedia.org. This is On the Media from NPR. I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, helping the nation value young people as a resource through research and programs, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The Charles Stewart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable and sustainable society, and the National Endowment for the Arts. Support from the media comes from the Bydell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science. Neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing. Or
politics.
Country music.
Hockey.
Sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.